This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, we got you both together today, reunited again. How are you both doing?
Good, good.
It's a holiday miracle.
There we go. There we go. Oh, good. Well, Nathan, it's good. Your intro skipped just a little bit, so we're having audio problems already. It's just like old times.
It's good. Well, that's part of the charm of the show is that half the time when we're answering each other, we're like filling in gaps. Like, oh, I only heard about, 20% of your sentence, but I think what you said.
Plausible deniability.
That's why we're just adding value all over the place. Yeah, this is tremendous.
God. All right.
Well, for those who are wondering, I'm not qualified to be a podcaster. I halfway even know how to edit this stuff, so I don't even have the degree or the credentials.
That's good. Well, it shows. We're authentic. That's it.
Yeah.
That's how it works. Oh, my goodness. Well, it's great to be back all at once. All good.
All right. Well, any news that you guys are, I guess you guys are coming out with a, well, any new Hawk Blocked episodes that you guys want to talk about or any news you guys wanted to discuss yet?
Yeah, we do our focused political bitching mostly on Hawk Block these days. we're trying to have different audiences for different offerings. So.
Right.
We did a show last week, which is it's still up only from my Patreon, but it'll be on Odyssey here in a couple of days, and then we'll do a new one here probably this week. Yeah.
Yeah, we feel it. I'm feeling the need.
Yeah,
we feel the need
to do. you and President Biden.
That must be why I made that crack. It was rattling around the back of my skull, that story. All right. Well, let's.
It's
not,
a rumor.
Let's
it's, not a, it's only dis- a rumor.
Let's
we
not
don't,
descend yeah. into the gutter. Let's. let's show a little class. So Nathan, what do
we
have?
Are, yeah,
okay.
Very good.
Questions?
Yeah, we've got some fun questions today. One of them is about the diet of our species, the human-specific, species-specific diet. We've got a question about retiring early and whether that sets up any type of complacency. And we've got some getting stressed out and what people did in the Stone Age. And then the rest, we're just going to take a little bit more after that as well. So our
we
first
have
question:
some heartbreak with some guy that did a girl wrong. God.
Well,
what's this podcast coming?
We're going to leave that one where it's like closer to the holidays because that's when that tends to happen.
Oh, Jesus!
All right. Yeah.
Fabulous.
when the plane tickets are just cheap enough that you can,
so proud of myself.
The boys. The boys are feeling punchy today. Watch out, people. Let's do this thing.
All right, let's go. What do we got?
All right, dear doctors, my question is about how evolutionary psychologists can interpret the species-specific human diet differently. Mm-hmm. Dr. Lyle supports a plant-based starch-heavy diet. Meanwhile, Dr. Jeffrey Miller supports a paleo diet heavy in meat and greens. It seems clear that the majority of calories were gathered, not hunted, which lends weight to the plant-based, starch-heavy type of diet being the standard human diet and the correct one to follow. But how can researchers have such different interpretations of human diet?
People can be ignorant and getting outside of their range of knowledge, which is what Miller has done. So the it's perfectly understandable. I'm sure I've done the same thing. In other words, I've taken my knowledge, very solid knowledge of evolution and evolutionary psychology, and extrapolated into questions where I didn't have a lot of specialized knowledge, and I make an educated guess. And a lot of those educated guesses are right. And some of them are undoubtedly wrong. And that's what happens when you...
Provably wrong.
Yeah.
Demonstrably, obviously, blatantly, provably wrong. Just saying.
Yeah, just go ahead. That's right. That's good. So here I was trying to get a bunch of credit for being humble, and this is what I get. This is what I get for that.
Just keeping you honest.
I have a mute button here just in case, Dr. Lyle. You know?
So anyway, the bottom line is that Miller doesn't know as much as we know. Okay, so he's a rookie in that space, and so he's doing a cursory look at the situation. And to be fair, I know I read, I can't remember where I read this. I think I read some of his machinations on this in the book Mate, and I remember just rolling my eyeballs and understanding how confident he felt and yet how wrong he is. So how do we know that I'm right or we are right and Jeffrey Miller's wrong? Well, the way we know is from direct scientific evidence. So it's going to turn out that he's undoubtedly correct in the sense that that our ancestors ate a lot of meat. There's no question that they did. The vegans of the world that stick their heads in the sand and jump up and down and say that isn't true are just being ridiculous. It's obviously the case that they did. But what they ate and what would be optimal for the species are two different things. And that's because there's evolution doesn't try to solve the question of what would be the optimal thing for you to be eating to extend your life expectancy versus what would be the optimal choices for you to be making in order to statistically increase the likelihood of your survival.
It doesn't care about longevity at all, really, unless you're reproducing that entire time at the same rate that you were when you were younger.
Or long-term health either, right?
Or happiness. Doesn't give a crap.
It would be a tremendous mistake not to be eating meat necessary for your survival between the ages of 3 and 60. Like if you were to go down at 47 because you were short of calories, that would be a disaster. It's like, wow, you left a lot of stuff on the table. And so, of course, the idea is to... Don't worry about the fact that you could truncate your life by 5% of lifespan at the end with a diet that is heavy in animal food. Now, how do we know that the diet's heavy with animal food is a problem? Well, we actually don't know. We can't put Miller's question to the test very well, or his hypothesis. And the reason why we can't do that is because we don't have people eating significant amounts of meat in their diet that is essentially organically grown meat that is hunted and is therefore doesn't have a bunch of toxic materials in it and doesn't have a weird macronutrient, an amino acid breakdown. So we don't have some, pig eating a bunch of corn that it wouldn't be eating exclusively as its diet and therefore having a very strange, fatty acid profile, for example. So the animals that people are eating are not the animals that you were hunting and eating in the Stone Age, for one thing. And then the animal food that is being eaten is not being eaten juxtaposition to organically grown whole natural plant food. So if you had a situation, which I believe to be the case, that if you had organically grown natural animal food that you hunted and you ate that, and let's suppose it was 25% of calories, and you ate that next to 75% of the rest of the calories came from organically grown whole natural plant food, unprocessed plant food. What do I think that diet, how does that stack up? And my attitude is, I'll bet it's outstanding. I bet it's coming very close to a whole natural plant foods diet of today. So in other words, I think the antioxidant load in those 75% plant foods is basically deactivating the oxidative problems associated with eating the animal protein. So I believe that that's true. I believe that the evidence is pretty strong that people manage to eat what I consider an atrocious diet, and they stagger to 80, for God's sake. It's incredible how that these people can survive with what it is that they do. Miller would say, oh, these carbs are terrible. Really? Well, have you ever come to the McDougal program and watched 40 people who waddle in there, way overweight, wheezing on 5 medications with their blood sugar levels through the sky? And, you know, and maybe he's listening to Joel Fuhrman and talking about how potatoes cause, you know, people to be diabetic and blind or whatever the hell it is that these people think. And I watch them eat a very high starch-centered diet for 10 days, and they're well. Their blood sugar levels crash. They will go from very high on 4 medications to normal in 10 or 12 days. Okay, so that's a routine finding that takes place. So trust me, people do really well on these natural carbohydrates. I don't think Miller knows the difference. I don't think that he knows the difference between white bread and brown rice. And he sure as hell knows go ahead.
I want to defend him a little bit because I do follow him on Twitter. And I think some of his arguments, his more carnivorous paleo arguments, predate his current pair bond because she's vegan.
Ah.
And I think she has introduced him to ethical veganism and the sort of effective altruist argument for reducing animal suffering. And so I've seen him tweet things like, you know, yeah, we were probably meant to, in scare quotes, from a sort of ancestral perspective, eat meat. But if you're interested in reducing suffering and acting like an active moral agent in your own life, you're better off eating red meat than eggs and fish and chicken, for example. So he makes kind of nuanced points that are intersecting with his current ethics and his current signaling to his partner.
Got it.
Now wife, I believe, actually.
Right.
So I think he's walked back some of this extreme stuff, and I think now he might be friendlier toward, you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth and how he would talk about this, but slow carbs over fast carbs, or, you know, he's still very skeptical of processed carbs, but I think he's friendlier toward things like potatoes and brown rice.
Right. So, but he still doesn't know. So he still doesn't understand also that the animal food, if you look at worldwide evidence and look at correlation coefficients, it's fucking deadly. It's very clear. Okay. It's very clear, not only with respect to vascular disease, but all kinds of diversified cancer. And so he doesn't know this. Okay. And so this is an example of, like I said, a smart person using a logical argument, feeling very confident about it because it falls and makes a nice evolutionary. And he knows enough about cultural anthropology. He knows there's people out there, you know, he knows there's no vegan community, hunter-gatherer community, i.e. a primitive community in the world. No such thing. Everybody's got a spear in their hand. Everybody's fishing. So he understands where we came from, and we very definitely came from men hunt, women gather. They come together at the end of the day, and they trade it out. Okay, this is straight Richard Wrangham. So he knows all this, but he doesn't actually understand that a whole plant food vegan diet dodges every bullet that's associated with the animal food, and is not in any way inimical to people's health by virtue of being high carbohydrate. So all carbohydrates aren't even remotely the same in terms of their effects. So yeah, that's the story, and all good. And, you know, one day he'll be better educated than he is now. There we go. Yeah.
Maybe 2 weeks on the McDougal program.
Yeah, well, actually, all he really needs to do, there's 3 books he needs to read. He needs to read the brilliant trinity of Colin Campbell. And if he does, he could read any one of them. Any one of them is an absolute jewel. But if he reads all 3, it's done. It's like now you're an educated human. And there's really nowhere to go but you know, bow your head and say, thank you, now I understand. So that's how that works.
Wonderful.
All right.
All right. Yeah, I know with the, especially being part of FastingScape, I get a lot of calls of people wanting to do fasting because they're on the low carb diet. And so fasting was the next logical extension of that. And so it's interesting to kind of walk that through the logic of no, carbs are good and good carbs are good. And all of a sudden people are happy that they're back on potatoes and rice and beans. Yeah. So
I bet. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. It is astonishing here now 40 years into this to still be running into people that are curious, interested, and intelligent, that have been paying attention and remain lost. It's an astounding thing, but hey, such is life.
Now, Dr. Lyle, when you first got into practice, was the Atkins diet, which is, you know, now the rebranded version, was that pretty popular when you started to talk to patients?
I'm actually quite a bit older than that. Yeah,
You don't have to admit it.
I'd already been around a while by the time Atkins hit his heyday. So, Atkins was a... Atkins, John McDougall called that. He goes, oh, here comes another one, another annoying, you know, ketogenic sack of shit. And he didn't put it that way. That's the way I would put it. But yeah, so you know, we go back further than that to Beverly Hills Diet, Scarsdale, you know, these things that preceded Atkins. The ketogenic trick has been around for a long time and taken several different forms. Atkins was just the best marketed version.
Okay. Yeah, I wonder if by this point you can see it coming.
No. All right, let's talk about something else. God.
All right. All right. Dear doctors, I'd love to get your take on the FIRE movement, standing for Financial Independence Retire Early. Is it just another example of the Enlightenment trap? I read a book called Your Money or Your Life in my mid-20s, and since then, I've been saving approximately half of my income. I now have enough to frugally retire if I want to, but now I don't have a goal to work towards. I've always wanted to travel and learn foreign languages, so I'm doing that, but I know that if I wasn't taking classes every day, I'd be bored out of my mind. Did I just waste the last decade of my life engineering my very own complacency cage?
That's awesome.
That's a great question. Go ahead, Jen.
I don't think you necessarily wasted it, but you did engineer a complacency cage. So now your task is to, and sometimes we refer to this as the animal in a zoo problem. And, you know, this can affect anybody who sort of sits in a position of financial security, whether it's somebody who's worked really hard to get where they are, or they've come into a big inheritance, or they won the lottery, or just whatever it is. It really robs people of the process in life which confers the greatest amount of happiness, which is to come right up against the limits of what you are easily capable of and push yourself to challenge yourself. The main source of good feelings and productivity and happiness and self-esteem and all of these things that we talk about, the main way that you're going to create that for yourself is to demonstrate to yourself that you're capable of doing something that you weren't sure you were going to be able to pull off, and to impress yourself. And the only way you can impress yourself is to challenge yourself, to live at the edge of your comfort zone, as the cliches have it. And, you know, those little refrigerator magnets are true. Life does begin at the edge of your comfort zone. And so you've put yourself in a situation where, for a certain personality, you know, because you've been very responsible and you've really set this up nicely for yourself, you wouldn't have anything productive to do, and you would sit there and languish like an animal in a zoo. And a lot of people do that, and it really corrodes happiness and well-being. So this is about discovering, now that you have this space and latitude, you know, how do you continue to be of use to the village? How do you continue to produce and make efforts in a way that reassures you, both through your own behavior and through the feedback that you get from other people, that you are contributing something valuable and unique to the village economy? And we don't know exactly what you do and what that might look like and how we could you know, game that out for you, but that's essentially the task. You need the feedback from others, and you need the feedback internally from yourself, that you know you're not just you know, resting on your laurels and collecting interest on your accounts. You're in an active process of improving your life and moving forward.
Wow.
Beautiful. Yeah. Animals don't retire, people.
Yeah, never.
They just don't. Okay. And I watched my mother, who at 88 is obviously living on past accomplishments, which is a thing that other animals can't do. And let me tell you something. She wishes that it were not true. She is haunted by the fact that she does not contribute. And it makes her, every now and then she'll tell me she should just die. Okay. And that's because she's got enough awareness in there to calculate and realize, you know what, I'm costing the village. I'm in a net negative situation. And so I use my personality and my love for her to essentially bamboozle her out of that reality. Okay. But the truth is she's got enough sharp and enough honesty to recognize it from time to time, and it will fold in on her from time to time, and it's not pleasant. Okay. She would, in fact, sometimes, because she's, you know, pretty severe dementia, sometimes she will she'll say, well, you know, I could get a teaching job because I have a lifetime teaching credential. Hmm. And so that's rattles in her head that means you could teach for life. And so, and she thinks that somehow she could still do it and she ought to be doing it. So yeah, the animal in a zoo, this is not, we don't want to be fed and watered and taken care of by other people. We want to earn it in an active exchange process in the village, not necessarily every day of your life, but, you know, in a steady stream of evidence of productive capability. So, it may be that what you do is you have a home that you bought and paid for, but you keep it up very well. You know what I'm saying? So you may not actually earn something in the village, but you're busy, you're active, you're thinking, you're learning, you are keeping yourself competent in some important ways. So
yeah, learning new languages, yeah, yes. You know, which the question refers to is we'll do that. And, you know, practicing them and joining online communities where you can have conversations in new languages, push yourself in uncomfortable ways to practice, and then go to those places and practice. Like this doesn't necessarily have to be an unpleasant process. It shouldn't necessarily be an unpleasant process. It's just it's about accomplishing and achieving and acquiring skills that you didn't have yesterday that you can then demonstrate and signal to the village, whether that's just in principle or you actually do it, so you get that feedback, or that you imagine you would get that feedback if you were to go show the village.
Yeah, you have to be doing something that your brain can see somewhere down through it that this is increasing your survival reproductive capability. So those value judgments are embedded in the adaptive unconscious. And so if it feels boring and feels useless, your brain can't see how it's useful, or it knows that you could be doing something else that would be, feels like it would be a lot more productive. So yeah, anyway, Jen, I'm like trying to pile a can of beans on top of a really good cake. There's no need to add anything.
It's good carbs, Dr. Lyle.
She did a great job.
It's carbs.
Yeah,
it's
carbs. There you go.
Wow, thank you.
All right.
Animals don't retire. That's amazing. Yeah. I think that's going to stick with me a long time. So, yeah.
All okay. Right.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle. Thank you, Dr. Hawk. Sure. Okay, our next question. Nowadays, a lot of people gravitate towards food when they are stressed. What did people do in the Stone Age when they were stressed? Did they fight? Did they sleep? Did they meditate? Did they go on walks? Did they talk about it? And what about animals? What do they do when they feel stressed?
Well, I don't know. I'll just meander and then Jenny, correct me. If you're stressed, you're in a situation where you're feeling you're feeling some challenge or possibly uncertainty, cognitive dissonance about your ability to get something done, and either ability to do it or do it within a specified length of time. You're stressed over the basically resource allocation, decision making, etc. Whatever it is, stress. Most of it, whole heck of a lot of it, comes from time pressure, money pressure. But time pressure being a very predominant issue. The a feeling of disquiet or discomfort can be one of the most productive things you can do to increase your likelihood of survival is to eat some rich food. That is you'll get short-term feedback from that tells you that was a pretty good move. That's not going to happen if the food is low calorie density. So when people get stressed, they don't go to the kitchen and grab themselves some kale out of the refrigerator and start chomping on it. That's not what they do. Okay. They go for something that has high calorie density because that's signaling to the system. It's going to give it a dopamine and then subsequent endorphin bath that says, that was good. That was good. We just increased our likelihood of survival. Yeah. So essentially the nervous system is under stress. It's scanning around looking for how it can, what's the most efficient biological thing for it to do. And so, if it could remove the source of stress easily, it would. But if it can't, if it's complicated and it's energy intensive and it's not certain how it's going to manage it, then it's scrolling down through a list of options. Like, for example, talk to my ex-wife about how to deal with the note that she and I borrowed, and then we're going to give to the mother-in-law and the interest rate and when it's going to be due. And oh my God, how am I going to deal with it? And then I got to talk to my wife about how I'm going to do that and what junior's college fund. And like, you could just feel the stress, all kinds of different considerations. And now the due date is coming up on it. We got to make a decision next week, and we're going to have to sit down, and haven't been getting along too well with the wife anyway the last couple weeks. And so now it's going to be stressful right in the middle of that. It's not a good time. And see, stress. Okay. So the organism says, okay, how could we remove the stress? Well, if we could somehow get rid of this conflict. So it turns its mind and it can't figure out how to get rid of the conflict. It's already been, it's been dealing with this conflict for 13 years. Okay. In other words, it's a complicated mess with personalities and all kinds of situations in it. All right. Now, so we've got stress from whatever reason. Stress is coming from conflict. And so the mind is scrolling down through its options, and it's looking for where can I spend 5 minutes of time and energy and muscular effort and get a big bang for it? Where can I do it? Well, what about clipping my toenails? Well, no, my toenails aren't too bad. Okay. Can I take a shower? No, I really don't need a shower. I mean, I don't feel like I need it. Okay. Well, what about, is there the peanut butter sandwich that I could fix? Well, now you're talking. Okay, so the brain is calculating the biological value of different options, and it's running those things in parallel, and it's selecting the behavior that has the biggest bang for the buck. And guess what's always going to have a pretty big bang for the buck? It's going to be supernormal stimuli. So that's why people are going to turn to, smoke a joint, have a drink, have an ice cream cone, have a Snickers bar, have a peanut butter sandwich. In other words, they're going to do things that are going to cause, they're going to be super normal, and they're going to cause a dopamine endorphin cascade. So that's why. And so in the Stone Age, no, they probably didn't turn to food because there wasn't any available. They would have had to go get some. So that's, that's what I think is going on. I don't think that this is super interesting from my standpoint. And this is this is the closest thing to where my observations dovetail any discussion of what we call emotional eating. I don't really, if you want to call this emotional eating, hey, fair enough. Okay. But as I pointed out, emotional eating is a broader concept of I have underlying issues. I've been traumatized. I have unfinished business from my childhood. You know, I'm in a big, you know, stressful relationship with this, that, and the other. It's like, no, you know, that's not why you're eating the crap. But you may eat some crap or you may eat rich food behind momentary selection under stressful situations where your mind is cycling around looking for the highest biologically efficient option. And then turns out it selects some supernormal stimuli, whether it's a shot of whiskey or a cigarette or some marijuana or, you know, a cinnamon roll. The same concept. A very low effort, big time dopamine endorphin cascade, and supernormal. That gets in, it wedges its way into what would otherwise be a nervous system searching around for the best solution to an array of stressful decision making. So you can see that these things have a strong tendency to be essentially counterproductive relative to health, but they give the brain a little time out. And that's kind of how I see that. So that wouldn't have happened in the Stone Age because they didn't have super normal things like that. But it's been happening ever since human beings concocted drugs and undoubtedly rich foods for wealthy people, and now they're ubiquitous. Is that all? How's that sound, Jen?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly that distinction between, what constitutes emotional eating is always important to make, because you don't, no matter how stressed out you are, no matter how much childhood trauma you're trying to resolve, you're never going to stuff mouthfuls of kale from the fridge. Like, it's just that is never going, I've never seen that happen. I've never heard of anyone telling a story like that. I think you also are looking at, when people kind of run against the limits of, okay, well, there's nothing productive to do with my feeling of agitation and stress right now. Mm-hmm. That's where you see individual difference. You know, you have some people get really quiet and keep their own counsel and sit in the corner and not want to do anything until they have more information. Mm-hmm. You have other people who get very restless, very like, I have to do something. So I'm going to go have conversations and do this and figure this. I'm going to go meddle. I'm going to go try to, these are individual differences that different people have and reaction to exactly the same kind of stressful situation. I can see it in my pets. I can see it in your pets. You know, some pets when they're anxious, Mo gets very trembly and chirps a lot and whines. Yeah. And Melly gets very, she wants to be close. She wants to cuddle. She obviously goes stealing food if she can find it. But she, even in a state of great stress, is not stealing the kale from the refrigerator. So to answer that general question of, well, what did they do in the Stone Age, is a little overly broad, just like it would be to answer, you know, what do animals do? It depends on the species. And then within the species, it depends on the individual. Everybody's different in how they, you know, what constitutes stress for them. And then if there is no low hanging supernormal fruit to consume, then, you know, what do you do with that restless energy? That looks really different. Different folks.
Yeah. Right. Dr.
Lyle,
I remember. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Hold on a second. It's probably even goes further. I mean, not to get fancy or anything, but the nature of the stress itself probably causes domain specific reactions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I know when it comes to like paperwork and hassle, I'm so avoidant. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, just, sure, procrastination is always a great anxiety.
It's going to go away. You know, hope there's a nuclear war, and I'm not going to have to file whatever that is.
I was impressed. You sent out your tax documents. That
I did. People.
worth a round of applause.
All right. Yeah, Nathan, you had some questions.
Well. Yeah, I was just saying the nature of the stress. I remember Dr. Lyle when you said, like Dr. Hawk, I remember when you said maybe a year and a half ago, last time we had a question on the emotional eating, that if you go in the the bar after the Super Bowl, the people who are cheering for the winning team are still going to be drinking just as much as the team rooting for the losing team. But Dr. Lyle, I remember you also said that this is the same species that had to deal with Normandy, the Normandy Beach, and yet we would consider that extremely stressful. And for them, they had to do it. And so I wonder what the stress looked like in the Stone Age. You know, like you could die if you got some infection. Whereas
trust
today,
me,
stress is
big stress. Stone Age is full of stress, full of a major freaking political unrest inside villages and between villages. And you know, in other words, these are people are vulnerable. People freaking die. And so, Stone Age is stressful, people. So, you know, if you find yourself, you know, chewing a little tobacco at first base, you know, because it's a little stressful, it's no surprise that what's got people's attention is supernormal stimuli. You're talking about drugging that brain a little bit. That's the biggest reason you see the things that you see.
Well, this is why there's such a trope now with, life is just, we're dealing with more trauma now than ever in history. And that's why we have these epidemics of autoimmune or we have these epidemics of addiction or whatever it is. I mean, there's a lot of people who really straight-faced say this, you know, like, we've never experienced so much adversity and trauma in childhood before. Like, are you kidding me?
Oh my God.
It's amazingly willfully ignorant of human history up until very, very, very recently. And I think there you do have real cultural shifts around just the norms around discomfort and, the suck it upness, you know, like there's kind of a standard of behavior that has applied to, you know, Nate's bringing up Normandy, this kind of like, life is difficult. Life is shitty. Like we go through terrible experiences and you just kind of handle them. You push through and you don't talk about them and all these kind of norms that have applied to human groups and human behavior since time immemorial. So there's great, it's a wonderfully positive thing that some of that has been unwound in the last couple of generations and people can speak more openly about what they've been through and what's going on for them. Yeah. But with that has come this kind of denormalization of life sucking.
handling
it's
it.
I mean, in general, life does
my
suck.
Yellow shirt.
Yes, you this is the like, kind of the inflation, sort of diagnostic inflation of something like a traumatic event is just ridiculous if you look over the last several decades, where this used to speak to something that was a legitimate, you know, real physical trauma, and now it's, your words are violence, or I was in an unsafe space and I felt threatened by your ideas. And it's it's laughable that this can be compared apples to apples with what people have gone through in the past.
Boy.
Well, Dr. Hawkeye.
How did you put that, Jen? Diagnostic inflation. Man.
Yeah.
That's a term.
That's amazing.
Decade.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
That is beautiful. Absolutely fabulous.
Concept creep. Yeah.
Well, over the last couple of weeks, there's been a few challenges in my life that I hear Dr. Hawk, your words of your dad, just handle it. And it's helped me through. That's great.
That was his go-to line. Not that he always handled it particularly well himself, but you know, he tried.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, do you guys want to do one more?
At least he had a good sense of the tragedy of the human condition.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right, our final one. I was wondering if Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle have ever talked about the increase in angry, violent outbursts on airplanes and other places that have happened in this age of COVID. There have always been angry outbursts, but why have they seemed to increase now? Is it some kind of temper tantrum in reaction to the loss of control due to COVID? So my social media appears to be filled with these incidents.
Yeah. Well, let's keep in mind that I think there's like, you know, I don't know what it is. It's some amazing number, 2 or 3 million commercial air flights a year. So if on 10 of those or 1 out of 200,000, somebody's finally fed up with this ridiculous mask rule, then I'm hardly surprised, given human nature as I know it, that some 100 IQer with limited stress tolerance, you know what I mean, finally loses their cool. I mean, it's not like I don't see this on the basketball court at least once a week. So something that would be equivalent. So so anyway, I don't see this as particular notable. I'm surprised actually at how little it is. It's not a lot. Not by the numbers, people.
Yeah. I looked into this at some point because I was wondering how much of it was my sort of perception just because of the sort of Twitter effect and the iPhone effect, the fact that these things are documented and that they go viral and people post them and share them, and that they are recorded when 10 years ago they would not have been recorded. And so some of it is that, but it also has truly increased specifically over the last year, and it's almost all mask mandate stuff.
Yes.
And so most of the incidents, I think, 2/3 or more, were related to people refusing to put their masks on between bites or these other sort of, you know, the rules. And I think you have an intersection between that and really fed up flight attendants who have been working throughout this entire period of time and have just really, really had it. And they have to do their jobs. They're bound by these arbitrary rules. And so they may be a little less patient than they would have been with the same incident a couple of years ago. And so you do see, I think it's, you know, it's something between a 3- and 4-fold increase over previous years, but it's still the absolute numbers, are still quite small. So, I think this is exactly the kind of thing. I watched a documentary recently on sort of online shaming that was produced by Monica Lewinsky, of all people. It was done very well, although it came to some problematic conclusions from my perspective as a First Amendment absolutist. there was a moment where they interviewed my old friend Tristan Harris, who is the former Google employee, who's referred to as the sort of the conscience of Silicon Valley. He's spoken out a lot against kind of what social media has done to society and continues to do, and he's created a nonprofit to deal with this. So there's a short interview with him, and he basically said, you know what social media is like? It's like when you're on a schoolyard playground and there's a couple of kids who are having a conflict, but it's no big deal until other kids come around and start saying, fight, 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 fight. He's like, that is Twitter.
Got it.
Twitter is the other kids standing around saying, fight, fight, fight. And I think that's what happens with these kind of videos, is that the more insane it is, the more eyeballs it's going to draw, the more it gets shared. So there is this kind of selection bias on the most extreme incidents. When most of them, what the airline is recording as an incident, you have an increase in incidents because an incident is the flight attendant asks the passenger to put their mask on after they've finished their biscotti and they don't immediately comply. You know, there's sort of like it warrants some kind of escalation within the system that is not necessarily something that someone's going to get their iPhone out and record, but it's still triggers as an incident in the system. So you do have this absolute increase, but the extreme stuff is getting way overplayed as far as anybody can, you know, perceive it.
Gosh, I just found out I'm a First Amendment absolutist. I didn't know there was a group of us.
There's a group of us where our numbers are small.
Love it.
It's not a very popular position these days because, you know, words are violence. Silence is also violence. So it's a little confusing.
Misinformation is dangerous. Misinformation, like free enterprise and Milton Friedman and the whole natural foods, you know, a lot of things are misinformation and dangerous. What the hell?
Yeah. Yeah, if people don't know what it means, I mean, this First Amendment absolutism is really been the position of the United States Supreme Court up through the most recent First Amendment cases, i.e., you have the right to say anything you want in the U.S. as long as it is not a direct threat with imminent harm. So you can't, including hate speech. Hate speech is protected speech. So you can say vile, hateful, terrible things about individuals or groups of individuals, and this is unique to the U.S. You know, no other country in the developed world has the kind of First Amendment protections that we historically have. But you cannot make a credible threat against that person or that group that you know would warrant a law enforcement intervention. And so you have conceptual creep here as well, where, well, what constitutes a threat? Is making a threat qualitatively different in the age of social media than it used to be. So these are the sort of debates that the courts are struggling with now. I am one of the few who remains on the side of you pretty much have the right to say any terrible, horrible thing you want to, because I have the right to say whatever I want back to you.
That's right. And if you say something that is demonstrably untrue and it harms me, I can sue you. Okay.
Sure.
So that's fine. Right. That's all fair. And we go to court, you know, if it's touchy enough, and we hammer it out. But I'm disgusted that anybody would ever feel like we should have anything other than First Amendment absolutism, now that I know what it is. Yeah. That's me. Count me in, Jen. I'm on that team.
All right. We'll go to our little protest of two.
Let it. You know, this is what I also, this is kind of, one of the things that I mean, and you can see there's some personality differences here, and just, and God knows what else, but I don't know very much. You correct me if I'm wrong, Jen. I'm sure I'm probably not understanding this fully, but my understanding is that in England, the notion in court is that it's the job of the crown or whatever to find the facts and to, in other words, it's not an adversarial type of a system. Everybody's supposed to be aiming at the truth or whatnot. I think, isn't that kind of how that works?
My understanding, roughly, yes. And differing from ours in that ours is adversarial. Yeah,
my attitude is, let it be adversarial. In other words, you give it your very best shot. Okay, you make your very, very best case from your perspective. Let them make the very best case from their perspective. And let the judge or jury decide, and we'll live with it. Let's not curtail your ability to make your very best argument. And that's a little Wild West, free, you know, way of looking at things. And we're going to just tough it out rather than, you know, essentially tiptoe around something that might be unpleasant to say. So anyway, that's my position.
I mean, just to kind of take the devil's advocate position that the documentary made and why I found it troublesome was this sort of, you know, they highlighted several cases of people whose reputation livelihood had been essentially destroyed by online mobs. So something again, kind of going back to the idea that it's a schoolyard with people yelling fight, 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 that an incident that would not have reached many eyeballs in the past just has that moment, you know, where it has one day where it's trending, and people get doxxed, they have their address gets published, they get personally harassed, and they do, I mean, some of the cases that they look at in the documentary after experiencing direct personal harassment, they do seek remedies in court and they do win. And so that's still, that part is still working. But the idea is that these companies, Twitter and Facebook and YouTube or whatever, have some obligation to prevent that from happening, because this is a unique phenomenon where never before in history have people been able to exercise their quote unquote free speech by piling on these anonymous online mobs. And I'm sensitive to that argument, and I understand the distinction and what people are saying, but I think there is a way to walk that line and to preserve, you know, meaningful free speech without descending into the kind of free expression and censorship law that you get in Australia or in the UK, where, you know, you do have these, I just saw an article today in the UK that online trolls if they there's new legislation targeting sort of online expressions of hate that will be defined by literally the Department for Culture.
Oh my God.
Totally could not be more Orwellian. So the state is now determining what constitutes offensive speech and going after people who are engaging in that online, especially if it's anonymous or indecent or offensive or all of these things that the U.S. Supreme Court has historically vigorously defended. So, yeah, I don't know where that's going. I know there's a lot of demand for that in the U.S. now. There's a lot of people who do feel bullied and vulnerable, and that this kind of thing needs to be that you know they need the state to protect them against this sort of phenomenon. So I'm sure that there is an answer. I can't tell you exactly what it is, but I can tell you it is not a Department of Culture.
No. The answer might be to handle.
I think it's a sophisticated evolution of civil litigation.
That's really what it is.
Okay. In other words, in other words, if you're going to smear me and say a bunch of stuff that isn't true and destroy my reputation, I'm coming after you financially.
But if it's anonymous, if it's an anonymous troll online, I think that's the crux of this.
And you know what? That's
anonymous armies of trolls.
And you know what? That's that gets to be that's an interesting issue for the Supreme Court.
And so then do you have the right to sue Twitter for allowing those anonymous trolls to vent their spleen?
This is all great. This is in other words, these are like interesting legal problems, you know?
Yeah.
That's why we're supposed to have, you know, smart people on the court. Let's hope they can figure it out in the next 10 years.
Let's hope they all don't get fired for not being vaccinated.
Right.
I like the little tease for the upcoming Hot Block, Dr. Hockey.
It's been a week since our last rant, so we're overdue.
All right, thank you, Dr. Hawk. Thank you, Dr. Lyle, so much for chatting with us today. Have a wonderful night, and we'll look forward to speaking with you guys next show.
Great hearing
Sounds
you again,
good.
Jen. Gotcha.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.